Good morning. It's Thursday, December 19th, 2024. This is Upfront. I'm Brian Edwards Tiekert. On today's show, whole lot of news. We're going to start out in San Francisco, where the Board of Supervisors Budget and Legislative Analyst has just given a resounding stamp of approval to the concept of the city building its own social housing. We'll talk through the implications with Tim Redmond, founder of 48 Hills. Then we'll go to national politics, speak to Andrea Bernstein, co-host of Trump Inc., about the decision that came out of a New York courtroom that Donald Trump will not be immune from sentencing in the hush money trial, where he's already been convicted on multiple felonies. We'll talk through the implications as he assumes the presidency. In the second half of our program, we'll go through what comes next now that California has won from the Federal Environmental Protection Agency a waiver to ban the sale of gas-powered vehicles. And we'll take a look at the Supreme Court taking up oral arguments over whether TikTok, as we know it, can continue to exist. It's all coming up next after the news.
I'm Teresa Wersbianska with the KPFA News Headlines. A French court has sentenced Dominique Pellicot to 20 years in prison for drugging his then-wife, Gisèle Pellicot, and facilitating her rape by dozens of men over nearly a decade. The trial, involving 51 defendants, concluded with all being found guilty. 46 were convicted of rape, 2 attempted rape, and 2 of sexual assault. Co-defendants received sentences ranging from 3 to 15 years, with 2 suspended, sparking outrage among women's rights activists outside the Avignon courtroom over the light sentencing. Gisèle Pellicot, who waived her anonymity to ensure accountability, endured years of abuse orchestrated by her husband, who filmed the assaults. The case, which included defendants from various professions, has been described as one of France's worst modern sex crime scandals. Gisèle Pellicot speaks about the verdict.
Je pense enfin aux victimes non reconnues.
I'm thinking about the victims who aren't recognized and whose stories often remain in the shadows. I want you to know we share the same struggle. I wish to express my deepest gratitude to all those who've supported me throughout this ordeal. Your testimonies devastated me, and I was able to pull the strength from them to come back every day to face these long days of the trial.
Dominique Pellicot's lawyer indicated he might appeal the sentence. President Vladimir Putin has boasted that his military operation in Ukraine has strengthened Russia and denied that the downfall of a key ally in Syria had dented Moscow's prestige. The Russian leader sought to project strength and ease at his annual news conference and call-in show Thursday. As is typical, he used the tightly choreographed event to reinforce his authority and demonstrate a sweeping command of everything from consumer prices to military hardware. He claimed that nearly 3 years of fighting in Ukraine has hardened the Russian economy and the country's military, and hailed his troops' gains there. Russian troops are making steady, if slow, advances in Ukraine, but the Kremlin has also suffered some embarrassing setbacks. Israel carried out 2 waves of airstrikes today on ports and power plants in Yemen that it said were being used by the Houthi rebels, who have fired over 200 drones and missiles at Israel since the start of the war. The airstrikes killed at least 9 people, according to the Houthi-controlled satellite channel Al Masira, and came after a missile fired by the Houthis collapsed a school building in central Israel. Israel suggested that more Israeli strikes on the Iranian-backed militant group could be coming. Charles Della Desma has more.
Israel's defense minister says the country would not allow the continuation of shooting from Yemen's Houthi rebels. Hours after Israel launched heavy airstrikes on rebel sites, Israel Katz adds, I suggest the leaders of the Houthi organization to see, to understand and remember, whoever raises a hand against the state of Israel has a hand that will be cut off. Whoever harms us will be harmed sevenfold back. The statement follows a series of intense Israeli strikes that shook Yemen's capital and a port city and killed at least 9 people, officials say, shortly after a Houthi missile targeted central Israel and badly damaged a school building. I'm Charles Deledesma.
Workers at 7 Amazon facilities are on strike. The union said that the workers are joining the picket line today after Amazon ignored a Sunday deadline the union set for contract negotiations. The workers had authorized strikes in the past few days. It will take place in New York, California, Illinois, and Georgia. Amazon says it doesn't expect an impact on its operations. The Teamsters say they represent nearly 10,000 workers at 10 Amazon facilities. Amazon employs 1.5 million people in its warehouses and corporate offices. President-elect Donald Trump brings chaos back to Washington by attempting to kill a bipartisan budget deal with billionaire Elon Musk's help. Republican lawmakers have rejected House Speaker Mike Johnson's plan to avert a government shutdown after Trump condemned the deal and Musk threatened to end the political careers of Republicans who support it. Unless Congress approves new spending by midnight Friday, most federal agencies will shut down non-essential operations. Johnson's compromise plan included more than $100 billion in disaster aid to states hard hit by hurricanes Helene and Milton and other natural disasters. It also included $30 billion in economic assistance to farmers. Politico reports the Republican House Speaker Johnson is now considering passing a so-called clean funding package that excludes farm relief and disaster aid. Johnson's reversal came after Elon Musk, the world's richest person, wrote on his social media site X that any member of the House or Senate who votes for this outrageous spending bill deserves to be voted out in 2 years. Ben Thomas has more.
President-elect Trump has delivered a likely death blow to bipartisan congressional budget negotiations. House and Senate leaders struck a deal that would have kept the government funded into March and avoided a shutdown set to begin Friday. House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries says it would also
provide disaster assistance to everyday Americans whose lives have been upended.
But Trump rejected the measure as full of giveaways to Democrats, and Elon Musk had whipped up outrage on social media, writing "Kill the Bill" on X and threatening primary challenges against anyone who voted for it. Jeffries says
House Republicans will now own any harm that is visited upon the American people that results from a government shutdown.
Ben Thomas, Washington.
Unhoused individuals and their allies were removed from the park fronting San Francisco City Hall overnight. This after city officials in Oakland asked participants to vacate City Hall, prompting relocation to the Greyhound parking lot. After San Francisco police gave those staying in Civic Center Plaza an order to vacate, Tiny Gray Garcia, founder of Poor Magazine, an arts, media, and education organization, and a member of the encampment, shouted at the ring of officers which encircled the groups of tents.
You're evicting people from a safe place where we have nowhere else to go. We are everywhere we try to sit down, everywhere we try to sleep. This is so much violence. This is so wrong.
The groups are part of the Sweeps Free Sanctuary Communities movement, launched Tuesday across California to protest encampment sweeps and promote houseless-led housing solutions. Similar gatherings took place in Los Angeles, Fresno, Vallejo, and Seattle. The movement advocates for alternatives to sweeps, including permanent housing solutions like Homefulness and Wood Street Commons. Organizers call for public land to be used for community-led housing projects rather than enforcement actions that displace houseless individuals. In the San Francisco Bay Area, the weather today is sunny, patchy dense fog in the morning, highs in the mid-60s, and in the Central Valley, widespread fog, mainly before 9 a.m., otherwise cloudy through mid-morning, then gradual clearing with a high near 60 degrees. I'm Teresa Wears-Bianska with the KPFA News Headlines.
Coming up on 7:10 in the morning, the show is up front. My name is Brian Edwards-Tiekert. We're going to start with a local story today. The San Francisco Board of Supervisors Budget and Legislative Analysts just released a report on the feasibility of building social housing. That is housing developments built by a public entity for public purposes, but unlike the public housing of yore, not exclusively for very poor people. And it came back with a surprisingly bullish assessment of the feasibility and advisability of doing it. This is an idea that's been kicking around for a while in lefty policy circles, but this is a ringing endorsement from one of the larger cities in the country facing one of the biggest housing crises. Tim Redman is the founder of 48hills.org. Good morning.
Good morning, Brian. Happy to be on your show.
Walk me through the provenance of this report.
Okay, well, the first thing to understand is that the San Francisco Board of Supervisors Budget and Legislative Analyst is widely respected as a, you know, apolitical neutral observer. They're like, you know, very few people in San Francisco politics would accuse them of being too far to the left, too far to the right. They're, you know, they're very, very careful about their neutrality. So that makes this very significant. This is not a report coming out from, you know, Democratic Socialists of America or, you know, saying that this is a great idea. This is actually a very carefully written, and it's a very detailed report if you look at it. And what the idea here is to look at alternatives to the housing models that we have seen in San Francisco and in other cities, and look at, for example, what they do in a lot of European cities like Vienna, where I think, I believe like 60% of the population of Vienna now lives in what's called social housing, which is basically housing that was built by the government that serves a wide range of income levels. It's not, as you said, like the old social housing that is based, the old public housing that was designed just for very poor people. The idea is that a wide range of different income groups can live in this housing, but that the rent is set by your income as a percentage of your income. So the wealthier people would pay higher rent for the same apartment that lower income people would pay less rent for. And what this report says is that you can make this work financially. In fact, interestingly, you look at why we haven't seen a lot of housing built in San Francisco recently. It has nothing to do with zoning, most of which is, you know, restrictive zoning has mostly been eliminated by the state anyway. San Francisco has seen very little new construction and housing. And if you ask developers why they're not building housing, they say it just doesn't pencil out right now. The costs are too high and the interest rates are too high, and they can't get financing to build market rate housing right now. So very little is getting built. What the Board of Supervisors legislative analyst said is social housing does pencil out. There is a way to finance this. There is a way to build it. And there's a way to really kind of dramatically change the way housing is thought about in the United States of America. And as I say, the bottom line is they looked at six different scenarios. And in five of the six scenarios, it pencils out. It works. You can finance this. You can use existing financial models. They also talked about how San Francisco is moving towards creating a public bank. And one of the things that you would use a public bank for is to finance this type of housing. So it's actually a pretty important breakthrough. Outgoing Supervisor Dean Preston asked for this report about 6 months ago. And, you know, we don't know whether the incoming mayor, Daniel Lurie, and the incoming Board of Supervisors will pursue this. But what we do know is that if they want to pursue it, it works. And we're not talking about it works by, you know, raising taxes on San Francisco residents. The money is there. The city a few years ago passed a measure that raised taxes on very high-end real estate transactions, so-called transfer taxes on, you know, properties that are sold for more than $10 million. That has already brought in $300 million, which could be used as kind of bridge loans to finance a lot of this housing. Unfortunately, Mayor London Breed has refused to spend that on housing, but the resources are available. So when you look at this whole thing, it's that what the city is saying is, this makes political sense, it makes economic sense, it makes social sense, but it also makes financial sense.
Dean Preston requested the report. He is on his way out. He did not win re-election. Who might actually move this from a report to, you know, actual housing in the session ahead?
Well, that's what's going to be very interesting to see. Who is going to move on this? And, you know, it's the report just came out, and the city government is in a transition. London Breed is on her way out. She did not win re-election. Daniel Lurie, a billionaire heir to the Levi Strauss fortune, is coming, who has no political experience, is coming into the mayor's office, along with a board of supervisors that includes a few new people without a lot of experience. We will see who picks up on this. I mean, the people most likely to have pursued this previously were Preston and outgoing board of supervisors president Aaron Peskin. They aren't going to be there. Now, one of the new incoming supervisors is Jackie Fielder, who represents District 9. Jackie Fielder has been one of the leading advocates and one of the top people working on creating a public bank. And that's another story for another time. We could do an entire show on a public bank. You probably already have. But this kind of connects with the idea of a public bank. And I wouldn't be surprised to see, I have not talked to Jackie Fielder about this, but I would not be surprised to see her pick up on this. She's also talked a lot about social housing. And it really, though, depends on whether the new mayor is willing to pursue this model and willing to put resources that the voters have passed specifically for this kind of project towards making it happen.
So if I'm reading the report's top lines correctly, it's not just saying the city can build housing, but that the city can build housing considerably more cheaply than the private sector is, partly because of the financing mechanisms that it needs to avail itself of, partly because there's a lot of profit extracting actors it extracts from the process.
Yes, that's absolutely right. I mean, I always laugh when people like Senator Scott Wiener say, you know, San Francisco needs to build more housing at all levels. Well, since the 1960s, San Francisco hasn't built any housing at all. Cities traditionally don't build housing. Developers build housing. And, you know, we have two types of developers. There's the private for-profit developers, and then there's nonprofit developers. And the nonprofit developers use subsidies to build low and moderate income housing. But what this report says is, this, first of all, the city and county of San Francisco can raise money much more cheaply than private entities can, in part because the city can issue tax-exempt municipal bonds, the city can issue revenue bonds, the city's credit is very excellent and can borrow money at a low rate. And again, if we have a public bank, that public bank would have resources to put into this. So yes, first of all, the reason that private developers aren't building housing right now is financing. It's who's willing to put up the money for this. And two, it's profit. I mean, basically, you know, market rate housing developers aren't interested in housing. They're interested in making money. And that's the important thing to keep in mind, is that these business entities and the financing behind them, which is international speculative capital, they're not interested in housing people. They're interested in making a profit. And that profit is often fairly significant. And they need a fairly high rate of return to make this work. You eliminate the high financing costs and you eliminate the profit, and the price of building housing goes down significantly. So that is one of the things that the report says.
All right. Tim Redmond, we'll leave it there. Thanks very much.
All right. Thank you.
Tim Redmond is founder of the nonprofit newsroom, 48hills.org. The show is Upfront. My name is Brian Edwards-Tiger. We're going to turn to national news. The trials and tribulations are not over for Donald J. Trump. On Monday, Manhattan Judge Juan Merchan rejected an attempt by Donald Trump's lawyers to get his multiple felony convictions in his hush money trial tossed out. On grounds that a recent Supreme Court decision granted him broad immunity for conduct plausibly related in any way to his actions while in office. Hush money payments were made before he assumed office. Joining us to talk through what happened and what's next, Andrea Bernstein, journalist and co-host of the ProPublica podcast, Trump Inc. Good morning.
Good morning.
Do a quick recap for us. What was the argument being made by Trump's attorneys here?
So in the wake of the Supreme Court's immunity decision back in July, in the case Trump v. U.S., which your listeners will remember was about the January 6th special counsel case and whether Trump was immune, Trump's lawyers in the New York case went to the judge and said, you should toss out this case because under the immunity decision, certain pieces of evidence that were considered by the jury would not have been allowed in. And that all happened in July, so 6 months ago, but because of various twists and turns and delays, some of them related to Trump's lawyers, some of them related to the campaign, it was only decided this week by the judge that his conclusion was, in fact, the immunity decision does not affect this case because, as you alluded to, the actions took place prior to Trump's first presidency, but also because the evidence, some of which had to do with officials who were in the White House, who were talking about their discussions with then President Trump about the hush money while they were in the White House. And that was really what was key here. The judge said, well, in those cases, the testimony was between Trump and certain individuals, not having to do with the White House positions. And in fact, even if the evidence for any reason should not have come in, the error was what he called harmless error. So basically, for three reasons, the judge said, no, 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 I am not dismissing this case because of the immunity decision in Trump v. U.S.
But Judge Marchand is taking for granted that the federal Supreme Court can set immunity standards for a prosecution in the state courts?
Well, I mean, so there's a couple of things. Even though the judge is called state Supreme Court Judge Juan Marchand, this is in fact the lowest level of court in New York, so it's still appealable up through the New York court system. And many readings of the immunity decision say that, in fact, because this might have impinged on the presidency, there could be a way to get it back before the U.S. Supreme Court. So it isn't the last word on this, but it is also the first real test of the broadness, if you will, of the immunity decision. And the judge came down firmly by saying these things happened before Trump was president. There was a mountain of evidence, as prosecutors said, and the judge agreed, connecting Trump to these actions. A jury found that the Trump had committed 34 felonies. And for all of those reasons, the case could not just be summarily thrown out at this point.
So, as you said, this is the lowest tier of courts in New York. Presumably, this is a decision that's going to be run up the appeals ladder.
I mean, almost certainly. That's how Trump sort of got to the, this decision in the first place, by continuing to go up and up and up, including in cases where most legal commentators just thought, you know, he wasn't going to get anywhere. And you may remember that even before this case got to the U.S. Supreme Court, the court immediately below, the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, ruled unanimously, the entire appeals court, that there was no such presidential immunity. And Trump appealed it anyway, and it went to the U.S. Supreme Court, and they ruled otherwise. So almost certainly there will be more appeals. Nor is this, in fact, the final word that we may be hearing from Judge Marchand about whether the sentencing in this case can go forward. The proposal on the table is that the case would essentially be frozen until after Trump's second term as president.
That's the proposal from the Office of the Prosecutor, Alvin Bragg. Trump's attorneys have a motion pending to basically argue he's about to be president, he can't deal with this, just dismiss the whole thing on those grounds?
Exactly. So what they're arguing, and this is a separate case from the immunity case, so the immunity case arose because of the decision, the U.S. Supreme Court decision in Trump v. U.S. But this other argument is that Trump, who is now going to be the president, because there's a U.S. Justice Department regulation that a sitting president cannot be prosecuted, that this case, the state case, should also be dismissed. They're arguing for reasons that it would be distracting, et cetera, et cetera. They are sort of saying that there's a U.S. Justice Department regulation that applies to a state court. So that is, you know, also uncharted. We don't know where anything is going to go. That decision could come sometime very soon, although, of course, we don't know exactly when. I just want to say that even though, you know, most of the legal experts that I've heard from think that the sort of bigger decision was the one that already came out because that involved interpreting new case law, that this one is, there's no indication based on anything that, you know, he said or did at trial or in all of the numerous rulings he made from the bench and in court papers that he would make that kind of conclusion. But all that said, we just don't know. We've never had a situation ever in the history of the United States where a president-elect has been convicted by a jury and yet not sentenced. So it is a completely new situation for U.S. law.
It's also kind of a test run for other state-level prosecutions. He's still potentially facing prosecution in the state of Georgia.
That is true. And, you know, in that case, we don't know because that case is, there's currently a question about whether that case should be handed off to another prosecutor based on a perceived conflict of interest between the DA Fulton County Fani Willis and the counsel that she had investigating the case. So that one is a little more confusing. However, it is clear that the case law does not favor an active prosecution of a president while he is in office. So the Supreme Court ruled in a case, Trump v. Vance, which is sort of the first time the Manhattan DA's case got up to the U.S. Supreme Court. This was in 2020, so while he was still president, and he had not wanted to turn over his tax returns to the Manhattan DA. And the Supreme Court ruled in that case that a local prosecutor could investigate a president, but did not make a determination about whether a local prosecutor could prosecute a president. So it's kind of an open matter. However, I mean, there was an intense trial. It was, you know, I covered the trial. It went on for 6 weeks. The jury obviously was really sort of grappling with the evidence in that case. So this is it's just a situation that, you know, we haven't had. I mean, I want to say that other countries do this. President Netanyahu in Israel is currently Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is currently on trial for corruption there. So other countries have prosecuted current leaders. It's not something that is sort of unknown in Western law. It's just something that we've never confronted in this country in this way.
Mm. Very strange that it's getting tested at the state court level rather than at the federal level where the most serious charges were being brought. But
a felony in New York is still serious, right? And Trump was convicted of 34 felonies by the jury, or they found him guilty on 34 counts of falsifying business records in the first degree. So, you know, there's a lot to be tested. But, you know, in some ways, like this was a sort of earliest case in time. It concerned events in 2016, whereas the other indicted felonies, the January 6th case, the classified documents case, the Georgia case, all resulted from actions taken in 2020 or after. So this one just took, you know, quite a long time to get to trial. And, you know, part of the reason is because Trump's lawyers kept arguing during his first term that because he was president, he shouldn't be investigated. So they did quite a bit to delay the investigation that time and are now arguing that, well, you know, it's too late. The time has come and gone for anything to happen. And Trump needs to focus on his presidency.
All right. Andrea Bernstein, we'll leave it there. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Always good to talk to you.
Andrea Bernstein's a journalist who co-hosts the podcast from WNYC and ProPublica entitled Trump, Inc. That takes us to 7:29 in the morning. The show is up front. My name is Brian Edwards Tekert. Quick note before we move on. Thank you, thank you, thank you to everyone who made a gift to KPFA in our brief holiday fund drive. As many of you know, we did come up short in that fund drive to the tune of about $60,000 when we ended full blast fundraising on Friday night. We are trying to make that up now with very brief appeals like this one. And I'm very pleased to report that to date, we have closed the gap by a little over $16,000. If you can find it within your means to make a year-end gift to KPFA, we need it. And also, every thank you gift that we had an offer during that fun drive is available right now through our website, www.kpfa.org. And thank you. Coming up in the second half of our program, we're going to stick with the courts. First, we'll take a look at the EPA's decision to grant California permission to roll out strict emission standards for vehicles that could see the end of gasoline-powered car sales by the year 2035. And then the Supreme Court's decision to take up arguments from ByteDance, the parent company to social video platform TikTok, against a law it says could effectively bar its ability to operate in the United States. That's all next, after the news.
I'm Teresa Wersbianska with the KPFA News Headlines. The number of people killed and missing remains unclear 2 days after a magnitude 7.3 earthquake struck the Pacific island nation of Vanuatu. More than 48 hours after the quake, the Ministry of Health said the number of confirmed deaths reached 10 early Friday, with the number expected to rise. The scale of the damage became clearer on Thursday when telecommunications was partially restored. The devastation is concentrated in downtown Port Vila, the capital, with aid and rescue efforts focused on water, shelter, and recovering trapped people. Some 330,000 people live on Vanuatu's 80 islands. Australian, New Zealand, and French aid has started arriving. The shooter who killed a student and teacher at a religious school in Wisconsin brought two guns to the school and was in contact with a man in California who authorities say was planning to attack a government building, according to authorities and court documents that became public Wednesday. Police were still investigating why the 15-year-old student at Abundant Life Christian School in Madison shot and killed a fellow student and teacher on Monday before shooting herself. Madison Police Chief Sean Barnes said two other students who were shot remained in critical condition on Wednesday. The city of Richmond advanced sweeping housing inspection reforms this week to enhance tenant safety and accountability. Scott Baba reports.
Richmond City Council approved a new housing inspection ordinance aimed at improving safety and accountability in residential units citywide. Leah Simon Weisberg is executive director of the California Center for Movement Legal Services, which has spent the last 2 years working on the ordinance. She said that the city of Richmond is actually a leader in tenant protections, but has, until now, failed to address the lack of routine inspections for residential rental properties.
Ironically, we passed rent control in Richmond because there was a building where the landlord kept raising the rent and yet was not maintaining the property. And the city just didn't seem to know how to get the landlord to make repairs, and just even getting them to come out and do inspections was really hard. And so we ended up passing rent control and just cause to address this issue. But even though Richmond has all of these great, you know, best practices, really the strongest in the state, it still did not have an inspection program for most of its units and was really struggling.
The new ordinance mandates inspections of all residential units every 3 years, eliminates self-certification for large buildings, and strengthens oversight of housing conditions. The ordinance builds on Richmond's legacy of tenant protections, which began with the city's 2015 rent control ordinance, the first in California in over three decades. The council will have a final vote on the ordinance next month, and if successful, will begin implementation next year. I'm Scott Baba, Pacifica Radio, KPFA.
It's highs in the mid-60s in the San Francisco Bay Area today, with a high near 60 in the Central Valley. I'm Teresa Wersbianska with the KPFA News Headlines.
That takes us to just past 7:34 in the morning. The show is up front. My name is Brian Edwards-Teeker. In environmental news, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency granted California the waivers it had requested to set more stringent state-level standards on emissions from cars and heavy-duty vehicles. The waiver will let California effectively ban the sale of gas-powered cars by the year 2035. And the waiver that applies to heavy-duty trucks could drastically curtail their emissions and likely force a large number of the freight vehicles operating in the state to electrify as well. This is a power that California has had since the advent of the Clean Air Act to set more stringent emission standards here that other states can then me-too their way onto. It's also a power that is under attack in the upcoming Supreme Court session. The Supreme Court has agreed to hear arguments from a set of fossil fuel interests that says that they can sue over the standards California sets. Joining us to talk about the situation, David Woolley, lecturer and director of the Environmental Center at the Goldman School of Public Policy at UC Berkeley. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Brian. Thanks for having me.
Walk us through the substance of what California now has permission to do. What will it mean in practice?
Well, this right of California to have stricter standards on mobile sources has been in place since 1967. It was granted by the U.S. Congress then and reaffirmed in 1970, 1977, and 1990 Clean Air Act amendments. And it basically says that if EPA approves, it may establish more stringent standards on emissions of motor vehicles than the federal. And that Clean Air Act also allows other states, as you mentioned, to copy the EPA law, copy the California regulation. There are about 12 states that routinely follow California in this, and that represents about a third of the U.S. Vehicle market. So this is a very significant opportunity to achieve clean air and reduce greenhouse gas emissions.
These actual rules, how radical a change will it be to outlaw new gas-powered vehicles?
Well, this has been happening gradually since, I think, 2013, when California passed the first of these that was starting a trend toward low emission or zero emission vehicles. And there's been controversy over it, but gradually that market for zero emission vehicles has grown, partly as a result of this policy. I think in the third quarter of 2024, almost 350,000 electric vehicles were sold in the United States, and a lot of those in California. There's something like almost 6 million on the road now from the cumulative effect of this. So this is a transition that's been underway for a long time, and I expect will continue.
Let's talk about the what next. Before we even get to the Supreme Court, Donald Trump is going to take over the administration that controls the Environmental Protection Agency on January 20th. He has not been a fan of these types of environmental regulations. Is there anything his agency can do to kind of take it back?
Yes, he did this once before. In 2019, he went through a rulemaking process, that is the EPA, his EPA went through a rulemaking process to revoke the waiver to California to pass this kind of rule. It didn't stick. It was challenged in court, but before the court reached a decision, President Biden reinstated the rule. So now he's back again, is threatening to revoke these EPA waivers again. And it's not just light duty vehicles. There are waivers issued for other types of vehicles. There are something like six still pending. So this is going to heat up as an issue. My sense about the issue is that we're still going to see a strong national and global momentum to transition away from fossil fuels. And this may be a bump in the road, but that momentum is very strong, and I expect it will continue.
Right. That's the big question, because ultimately the goal, the policy is to drive actions by automakers. They are all investing in electric vehicle development and deployment anyway, because they think that's the future of the industry. Like, how much of a difference do the rules actually make?
Well, the rules make a big difference. For example, when Elon Musk and his Tesla company were just getting started. It was the California rules that created the initial market niche. Now, of course, Elon Musk is a close advisor to the president-elect, and it'd be interesting to see how much influence he has over the president's views on electric vehicles and on California standards.
Elon Musk has come a long way. There's separately this argument going to the Supreme Court, already scheduled to go to the Supreme Court, over whether the fossil fuel industry has standing to sue over California's standards established under these waivers, which is a separate question from whether the Trump administration can revoke the waiver. Can you walk us through the stakes there?
Yeah, the Supreme Court action last week is significant for really two reasons. First, it essentially discarded or dismissed a claim by the state of Ohio and several other states that Congress violated the U.S. Constitution when it allowed California in the Clean Air Act to set emission standards for vehicles. And three U.S. federal courts of appeals have rejected that argument. And the fact that the Supreme Court decided to take up this case but not that issue is a strong signal that that's a loser. So the court will rule on another issue, which is whether certain oil companies had standing to appeal EPA's grant of a waiver to California. Essentially, the argument by the lower court was that they weren't really harmed, and if they were harmed, that harm wasn't redressable by a decision by the court, and the states just didn't have an adequate stake in the outcome. So this is a fairly technical legal issue that is often raised in court decisions, and it depends heavily on the facts of individual cases. So it seems very unlikely to me that the result will endanger California or EPA's authority to apply stricter vehicle standards. The Supreme Court might make it a little easier for the industry to get into court to challenge the EPA waivers, but suing isn't stopping.
It seems odd that the lawsuit is not coming from the auto industry, which is the industry directly regulated, but from entities with a stake in selling gasoline.
Well, in the early days, the auto industry did oppose California rules, mostly unsuccessfully. But there's a transition that's gone on in that industry, and they are building electric cars in the United States, and that they're recognizing a strong consumer demand for these vehicles, and so they were not part of this challenge to the EPA waiver, and my sense is that this back and forth about a waiver, presidential withdrawal, a reinstatement, federal courts will go on, but in the meantime, this market is going to grow. More vehicles are going to come on the market, more vehicle sales. And this is part of a broad transition, I believe, in the national and global economy. I see it all the time. There's this huge momentum towards a cleaner economy and one that it has cleaner air and protects the climate. And I don't think that Donald Trump's going to be able to stop it. He may be able to slow it down, but I am optimistic about this. And I think that corporations in the United States share that and are adjusting their production accordingly to meet that demand and the very real benefits, both in health and climate stability, that comes from these kinds of regulations.
Well, it's jarring to hear optimism in the morning news. David Woolley, thank you very much for speaking to us.
Thanks a lot, Brian.
David Woolley is a lecturer and director of the Environmental Center at the Goldman School for Public Policy at UC Berkeley. That takes us to just before 7:45 in the morning. The show is Up Front. My name is Brian Edwards Tiekert. Sticking with the courts, the Supreme Court yesterday agreed to hear a challenge from social video platform TikTok to a federal law that could effectively ban its operation in the United States, barring ownership structure changes that the platform says are virtually impossible. The arguments are scheduled for January 10th, while the Biden administration, which signed off on the new law, is still in office to defend it. Joining us to talk about it, Lauren Finer, senior policy reporter at The Verge. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Walk us through what the law in question does.
Yeah, so the law that is at the center of this case basically would force TikTok's parent company, ByteDance, which is based in China, to divest the company or face a ban of the app in the US. So, you know, the bill's sponsors will often talk about this and say, this bill isn't really a ban because there's an off-ramp for TikTok. All ByteDance has to do is sell the app, and TikTok can continue to operate here in the U.S. Our only issue is the foreign adversary ownership of the app. And meanwhile, TikTok says it effectively is a ban because ByteDance is unlikely to be able or willing to sell it.
The U.S. is its largest market. It's not like it's hiving off a small part of the company.
No, this would definitely be a big deal for ByteDance's business. But I think, you know, one of the issues here is that to sell the algorithm, ByteDance would have to get approval from the Chinese government. And it's not clear that China would be willing to do that. And, you know, China might have incentives beyond just ByteDance's monetary success to consider here.
This is really weird because the fact that they're arguing in court that the major obstacle to complying with the U.S. law is they would need approval from the Chinese government would seem to lend some strength to the this law is about dealing with a foreign adversary argument.
Yeah, that's exactly what the three-judge panel on the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals said about this. They said, you know, this bill really does provide an off-ramp because as long as ByteDance sells TikTok, it can continue to operate here. And if it's China that's standing in the way of that, if China is deciding not to allow ByteDance to sell the app, then why should that be the U.S. court's problem?
What allegedly nefarious purposes could the Chinese government use this social video platform for if it continues to operate in the United States?
So there's two main issues that U.S. lawmakers and intelligence officials seem to be concerned about. And to be clear, a lot of these concerns have been conveyed in classified settings, in briefings to lawmakers. And, you know, we saw after lawmakers heard this information, they went on to overwhelmingly vote to pass this law. But that said, we still really don't know a lot of the details. But the two arguments are, one, that through ByteDance's ownership of TikTok, ByteDance may be able to have some access to U.S. user data. And TikTok says, you know, there's not, its servers for U.S. users are not based in China. But the concern here is that China has a national security law that basically lets them have access to private companies' information if they're based there for national security purposes. So the fear is that data could end up in the hands of the Chinese government. The second fear is that China could somehow lean on ByteDance to change its algorithms to promote more propaganda or narratives that would help the Chinese government's aims to users in the U.S. So it's both the data and propaganda issue that they're worried about.
And this, as you said, sailed through with bipartisan support. At one point, it was even supported by incoming President Donald J. Trump. But there has been a big change of heart within corners of the Republican Party. How did that come about?
Yeah, so you might remember that Donald Trump actually was the first one to want to ban TikTok in the US. He issued an executive order trying to do this. That order, because of the way that they tried to structure it legally, was struck down. So that never ended up happening. And then TikTok went through this process through the Committee on Foreign Investment in the US to figure out what could they do to mitigate these risks. And that kind of never reached much of a conclusion. So, you know, while all this is happening, Trump leaves office. He decides to run for office again. We know that he ended up getting donations for his campaign from a major investor in ByteDance. And it's around when we find this out that we also find out that he's changed his tune and he's talking about saving TikTok. And I think he's really seen during the campaign that he got a lot of traction on TikTok. He likes what it did for his campaign. He talks about having a soft spot for it now. So he does have some sympathy towards TikTok now. That said, it's not really clear what exactly he plans to do to, quote unquote, save TikTok. And, you know, now that he's been elected, he's kind of been a bit fuzzy on the details of what that might look like. Maybe that would just look like him trying to facilitate a deal so that TikTok doesn't have to leave the U.S.
Well, I mean, he has control of all three branches of government. If he wants one, he could probably walk a change in law through Congress.
Potentially, I think the easiest thing for him to do would probably be to tell the Department of Justice not to enforce the law. But then you still have the law on the books. And, you know, that puts companies like Google and Apple that would be charged with, you know, removing TikTok from their app stores at risk if that ever changes. And, you know, remember, this is a bill that passed overwhelmingly in Congress. And, you know, in Congress, where not a lot happens overwhelmingly on a bipartisan basis, I think it would be a big step to have them pass another law repealing this one or something like that. So I think it's more likely that if we don't see it enforced, it's because Trump tells the DOJ not to enforce it or it's struck down by the courts.
I have to say there's a weird subtext to the fact that this law basically exclusively focuses on TikTok. And the subtext comes across to me as it is okay to surveil the heck out of a broad user base if it's for the purpose of selling ads. It is okay to algorithmically warp young brains as long as it's in the service of making profits. It's not okay to do those things if the Chinese government is tenuously involved.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's an argument you hear from a lot of opponents of this law is that, you know, we have all these other issues with privacy in the U.S. of even U.S.-based tech companies. In the court's order on this, in the appeals court order, they talked about how Congress also passed this data broker law around the same time that was about, you know, minimizing foreign adversaries' access to U.S. user information through data brokers. So that actually applied more broadly. And the court said, you know, it's not necessary that they passed both to show that this was a good faith effort, but the fact that they did shows that they're not just singling out TikTok. So that's how the court saw that argument.
All right. Lauren Finer, we'll leave it there. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Lauren Finer is senior policy reporter at The Verge. There will be arguments in the Supreme Court over the future of TikTok on January 10th. Before we let you go today, a quick look at what is happening on the stage. Richard Walensky has this review of 36, a run that has been extended through December 29th.
Back in 2015, the New York Times presented a list of 36 questions that, if answered honestly by two people on a date, will let them know whether their relationship will work. These questions were based on a study titled The Experimental Generation of Closeness. It was written by a team of five psychologists and published in 1997. So, what if you were to take a couple of millennial heterosexuals on Tinder put them in a bar, and over the course of their date, ask each other those 36 questions. Would they find love or walk away? Combine that with notions about the interplay between technology and connection, and you have 36, a world premiere play at Shotgun Players, Ashby Stage, through December 22nd. At least that's the intent of playwright Leah Nakano Winkler and director Michelle Talgaro. But what is really going on in this somewhat entertaining misfire is a relationship we've seen any number of times in a dozen rom-coms over the past 30 years, presented as realistic people in the unrealistic world of microphones, view screens, and text messaging. Take David. He's come with the idea that this meeting could lead to something more. He's attractive, smart, confident, feminist, self-made, spontaneous but not reckless, with a fulfilling and helpful job, and most importantly, he doesn't run away from a challenge. Then there's Jenny. She's horny, but not emotionally available, sloppy, ambivalent, clueless, friendless, secretive. She's Amy Schumer without comic chops, Meg Ryan without the cute, Sandra Bullock without the charm. In this non-rom, non-com, Soren Santos takes this cardboard cutout David and makes him as real as possible. It's a great performance. But Lauren Andre Garcia as Jenny is stuck. She can't be funny or sweet or endearing. We've seen that movie before. The real Jenny is an irredeemable mess. While the two actors sit at opposite sides of the stage, never touching, the sex is presented graphically and even grossly. For some women who aren't named Schumer, Bullock, or Ryan, it's a fantasy come true. No matter how awkward or uncomfortable things get, maybe there's a David out there still willing to ask those 36 questions. Shotgun Players, to its credit, gets kudos for presenting an original work that might well resonate with a younger audience. But 36 simply doesn't work. 36 by Leah Nanaka Winkler plays at Shotgun Players Ashby Stage through December 22nd. For more information, you can go to shotgunplayers.org. I'm Richard Walensky on Bay Area Theater for KPFA.
Again, after Richard Walensky filed that review, the run was extended at Shotgun Players through December 29th for what the Grinch Richard Walensky described as a non-rom, non-com. All right. That does it for today's show. Upfront airs weekday mornings at 7 a.m. We post information about our topics and guests at kpfa.org, where you can also dig through archives of past shows. If you'd like to give us feedback on something you heard or suggest something for us to cover, send an email to upfront@kpfa.org. If you'd like to send in a question for Monday's Corona Calls with Dr. John Swartzberg, send that question to coronacalls@kpfa.org. A big thanks to the people who make the show happen. Our producer is Kimya Akbari. On the controls, Kirsten Thomas. My name is Brian Edwards Tiekert. Thanks as well to Mitch Jezerich and Christina Onnestad for their contributions to the program. Stay up, stay tuned. Law and Disorder is coming your way in just over 2 minutes at 8 a.m.
To everyone who supported KPFA during this fund drive, thank you. Your generosity fuels our mission. Unfortunately, we didn't quite hit our goal, and we need your help to get over the finish line. There's still time to make a tax-deductible donation. Every dollar brings us closer to starting the new year strong. And don't forget, our thank you gifts are available until December 31st. Visit kpfa.org and show your support today. Together, we can keep KPFA thriving into 2025. Thank you for standing with us. KPFA, independent, fearless, powered by you. Every time it rains red, don't you know it's crocodile? You find your fortune falling. All over town, all over town, all over town. Be sure that your umbrella.
Yeah, I wanted to make a comment about a couple shows. I'm an avid Flashpoints listener. Thank you so much for airing the Alcatraz Thanksgiving. Thank heaven for the archives. I've never used them. I love the Senator Carolyn Casey. She has so many witty, beautiful comments, and I enjoy all the programming. Thank you so very much. Have a great weekend. Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
This is KPFA reminding you that radio never sleeps, and neither do we. 94.1 KPFA, 89.3 KPFB in Berkeley, 88.1 KFCF in Fresno, 97.5 K24ABR in Santa Cruz, 94.3 K232FZ in Monterrey, and online at kpfa.org.